This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, March 15th, 2023. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says U.S. aircraft will continue to fly and operate wherever international law allows, and says that Russian military jets downing a U.S. drone over the Black Sea yesterday was hazardous and part of a pattern of aggressive behavior by Russia. Secretary also says he spoke with his Russian counterpart about the incident. Just ahead, we'll hear from the Secretary and General Mark Milley, Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. White House Budget Director Shalanda Young testifies before the Senate Budget Committee defending President Joe Biden's $6.9 trillion federal budget proposal for fiscal year 2024. President Biden is in Las Vegas talking about lowering prescription drug costs, noting the more than two dozen drugs on a list the government has put together that says their prices have gone up more than inflation, and the manufacturers will be paying the difference to Medicare, and that'll lower costs for beneficiaries. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg at an FAA safety summit saying he's concerned about the recent increase in commercial plane close calls at airports and wants to study why they're happening and how to prevent them before a close call turns into something more serious. House Homeland Security Committee holding a field hearing on border security and immigration in McAllen, Texas, on the U.S.-Mexico border. Only Republicans showing up there. The chair, Mark Green, saying the Border Patrol chief has contradicted Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas' claim that the U.S. has operational control of the border. And House Republicans formally introducing their top legislative priority, H.R. 1, a package of energy proposals that they say will increase production and lower energy costs. We'll talk about it with Politico's energy and climate reporter, Josh Siegel. This from CNN. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin vowed on Wednesday that U.S. aircraft will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows, one day after Russian aircraft hit a U.S. drone over the Black Sea, forcing it to be brought down in international waters. Secretary Austin is the most senior official of the administration thus far to directly address the incident, which happened on Tuesday when two Russian Su-27 aircraft intercepted a U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drone. That from CNN. The secretary spoke at the Pentagon after a virtual meeting of the coalition of nations known as the Ukraine Defense Contact Group.
On Tuesday, Russian aircraft again engaged in dangerous and reckless and unprofessional behavior in the international airspace over the Black Sea. Two Russian jets dumped fuel on an unmanned U.S. MQ-9 aircraft conducting routine operations in international airspace. And one Russian jet struck our MQ-9 aircraft, resulting in a crash. And this hazardous episode is part of a pattern of aggressive, risky, and unsafe actions by Russian pilots in international airspace. Now, I just got off the phone with my Russian counterpart, Minister Shoigu. And as I've said repeatedly, it's important that great powers be models of transparency and communication. And the United States will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows. And it is incumbent upon Russia to operate its military aircraft in a safe and professional manner.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the Pentagon, a news conference after the virtual meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group. That's the alliance of over 50 countries which have been supporting Ukraine militarily since Russia's invasion just over 1 year ago. The TASS news agency in Russia reporting that Russia's ambassador to the United States said on Wednesday he had told Washington that Russia would, quote, no longer allow anybody to violate our waters. Defense Secretary Austin was joined today by General Mark Milley, Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They were asked by reporters for some more details about the drone incident and also that phone call between the defense chiefs.
Mr. Secretary, you said you spoke with your counterpart. Can you give us a sense of the Russians' reaction to the call, did they suggest to you their defense that this was an accident or intentional or that it never happened? Can you just give us a better readout of your call? And General Milley, have you spoken to your counterpart, or are you intending to do so? And do you believe, after what you've seen, that this was intentional? Is this considered an act of war?
Well, thanks for the question, Lita. I won't speak for Minister Shoigu, nor will I get into the details of our discussion. I'll just reiterate that the United States will fly and operate wherever international law allows. Now, we take any potential for escalation very seriously, and that's why I believe it's important to keep the lines of communication open. I think it's really key that that we're able to pick up the phone and engage each other, and I think that will help to prevent miscalculation going forward.
So, Alita, thanks for the question. On the intentionality, don't know. I do plan to talk to my counterpart, General Gerasimov. We have a scheduled call. We'll see if that works out. So, was it intentional or not? Don't know yet. We know that the intercept was intentional. We know that the aggressive behavior was intentional. We also know it was very unprofessional and very unsafe. The actual contact of the fixed-wing Russian fighter with our UAV, the physical contact of those two, not sure yet. That remains to be seen. But I can't. I can tell you with certainty, though, that we have absolute evidence of the contact, the intercepts, et cetera, and it's very aggressive. You've heard about the dumping of the fuel and everything else. We have video evidence of all that. So there's no question that that part of it's intentional. The actual physical contact of the aircraft, that I'm not so sure. So we'll have to figure that out. That we're not positive of that yet. As far as an act of war goes, I'm not gonna go there. Incidents happen, and clearly we do not seek armed conflict with Russia, and I believe that at this point we should investigate this incident and move on from there. But we will continue to exercise our rights in international airspace.
General Mark Milley chairs the Joint Chiefs of Staff at a news conference at the Pentagon, along with the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, after that virtual meeting of the representatives from the Ukraine Defense Contact Group. Associated Press notes that today's call between Secretary Austin and the Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu was the first between them since last October. Secretary of Russia's Security Council saying on Russian TV today that the drone incident is another confirmation of U.S. involvement in the conflict in Ukraine, and that Russia planned a search for the debris of the drone, saying, "I don't know if we can recover them or not, but we will certainly have to do that, and we will deal with it. I certainly hope for success." John Kirby, a spokesperson for the White House National Security Council, was interviewed this morning on CNN about recovering that debris.
So I have to ask you first off, has the drone been recovered, and what is the status?
It has not been recovered, and I'm not sure that we're going to be able to recover it. I mean, the where it fell into the Black Sea, very, very deep water. So we're still assessing whether there can be any kind of recovery effort mounted. There may not be.
Okay, so having said that, you said that the U.S. would do everything, every effort to protect our equities over there. Part of protecting the equity is securing the data that may have been on this drone. Has the U.S. been able to wipe the drone's data or destroy parts of it so that it is not useful to enemies, Russians?
What I can tell you, Don, without getting into too much detail here, is that we took steps to protect information and to protect to minimize any effort by anybody else to exploit that drone for useful content.
Okay, but you said, you're not saying for sure, you said you took steps to minimize so that others can't exploit.
That's
so that
right.
It's not foolproof.
We did the best we could to minimize any intelligence value that might come from somebody else getting their hands on that drone.
But others can get their hands on it, if possible. It's possible.
Well, I mean, I certainly can't speak for Russian efforts or what they may or may not be trying to take off the surface of the water. I can just tell you that we're still assessing that situation ourselves.
John Kirby, Strategic Communications Coordinator for the National Security Council, interviewed on CNN this morning. The U.S. Senate has confirmed the next U.S. ambassador to India Eric Garcetti, the former mayor of Los Angeles, Democrat when he was elected, filling a post that's been vacant for 2 years. The Senate vote was 52-42. KABC-TV in Los Angeles reports that Eric Garcetti's nomination has been stalled for the past year over allegations that he ignored accusations of assault and sexual harassment involving his former senior advisor, something Eric Garcetti denies. Of today's vote, again, 52-42 in the Senate, it was mostly party line, but seven Republicans voted yes: Susan Collins, Bill Cassidy, Steve Daines, Lindsey Graham, Bill Hagerty, Roger Marshall, and Todd Young. And three Democrats voted no: Sherrod Brown, Mazie Hirono, and Mark Kelly. This is Washington Today. From Reuters this morning, the U.S. Senate Budget Committee begins debate on Wednesday over Democratic President Joe Biden's $6.9 trillion budget proposal, as the collapse of a pair of banks threatens to ratchet higher the stakes of a partisan standoff on spending and debt. President Biden's proposal is an early step in a negotiation over the fiscal 2024 spending with Republicans who control the U.S. House, who say they will refuse to raise the nation's $31.4 trillion debt ceiling unless Democrats agree to sharp spending cuts. Failure to do so could lead to an unprecedented default by the federal government, which would rattle the global economy and markets. The White House Budget Director, Shalanda Young, will testify about President Biden's plan, which calls for nearly $5 trillion in tax increases on the wealthy and large corporations to help offset the deficit and shore up Medicare. That from Reuters. C-SPAN covered today's hearing. Here's Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin, asking Director Shalanda Young about federal budget deficit projections.
In your testimony, you said that this budget, the president's budget, reduced the deficit. In 2019, prior to the pandemic, we ran a deficit of $984 billion, which is still way too much. In 2022, it was $1.37 trillion. In 2023, it's projected to be over $1.5 trillion. The president's budget now is projecting $1.8 trillion. So from 1.3 to 1.5 to 1.8, how can you claim that's reducing the deficit?
Easily, Senator. My entire statement said we talk about 10-year budget windows. Over the 10-year budget window, if you go look at 2033, the president's budget would bring down deficits by $3 trillion, or nearly $3 trillion, 2.9.
But again, year to year. I mean, I think most people say when you're reducing their deficit, you're looking at year on year. So we're going from $1.3 trillion to $1.6 trillion to now $1.8 in the budget. You're actually increasing the deficit by about $300 billion in 2024 is your projection over the 2023 projection. You're increasing the deficit. And by the way, that's a massive deficit, $1.8 trillion. What do you think is sparking inflation, which caused the Fed to start increasing interest rates, which is causing the run on these banks? At what point are you going to acknowledge the harm that this massive deficit spending is causing our economy? You're certainly not recognizing in your 2024 budget.
Senator, what I hope we all realize is that inflation is a global phenomenon. The UK doesn't have the same laws over the last few years that the United States has, and it has inflation. India, the same.
Again, when America sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold.
Senator, it absolutely has nothing to do with one piece of legislation. Every developed economy in the world is experiencing inflation. What that tells us is it's not one piece of legislation passed by the United States that has an impact, a large impact.
It was trillions of dollars of deficit spending, trillions of dollars printed chasing too few goods. That's what caused inflation, and that's what was promoted by this president.
Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin, questioning the Office of Management and Budget Director from the White House, Shalanda Young, at today's Senate Budget Committee hearing on the fiscal year 2024 federal budget. When President Biden unveiled his budget proposal last week in Philadelphia, he said, "I guarantee you I will protect Social Security and Medicare. I won't allow it to be gutted or eliminated by MAGA Republicans. My budget will not cut benefits, and it definitely won't sunset programs like some of my MAGA Republican friends want to do." At today's Senate Budget Committee hearing, Senator Mitt Romney, Republican from Utah, challenged Director Young on that.
"I'm not aware of anyone in this category, but are you aware of anyone of the elected officials we have in the federal government, at the Congress, or anywhere else, that have proposed cutting current or have currently proposed cutting benefits for Social Security of any kind?
Senator, I have heard of proposals.
You've heard of proposals from a current senator, currently or congressman, currently proposing to cut benefits to Social Security.
Yes. Have they changed their position?
No.
Maybe.
No.
But yes. Members who are current.
I said, has anyone current? I mean, in the last several months or the last year, has anyone, Republican or Democrat, proposed Social Security benefits?
So now you're asking if people change their position? Maybe.
Are you aware of anyone?
There is a record.
Are you aware
of
anyone? Excuse me. Are you aware of anyone proposing cutting Social Security benefits?
Your first question, current members have well-known policies out there to cut Social Security and Medicare.
That's simply wrong. That is simply wrong. And it's not honest to say that to members of Congress. That is simply wrong. There is no one who's recommending cutting Social Security benefits. All right? Number one. Number two. Do you recognize that in the next 10 years or so, the trust fund on Social Security is going to run out, and under the law, benefits would be cut dramatically, like 25%? You're aware of that?
I'm aware.
Yeah. That's a problem, right?
Of course.
Well, why is it then that in the president's budget, there's no effort to address that whatsoever?
And while we clearly disagree on this, there are some who have policies on websites. I'm happy to print them and send them to the committee. Whether they have changed their position is another thing. Who want to cut, have policies.
I'm sorry, that was not the question. The question was,
so this president,
I'm sorry, you've got to answer the questions
so
as opposed to change the topic.
Has put forth
I asked the question,
why
does the president's budget not
cut?
Lay out what how you would protect
Social
Security?
This president believes the existential threat to Social Security are those who want to cut it. His budget says no.
There's nobody in this committee that wants to cut it. I know of no Republican or Democrat in the House or the Senate who is proposing cutting Social Security benefits, and it's dishonest to keep saying it. It's offensive and dishonest and not realistic. We have a problem in Social Security. We need to address it. You agree we have a problem in Social Security. Make it clear, 1,000%, no Republican is proposing cutting Social Security benefits. Now, the question is, why have you not proposed in your budget any action to protect Social Security?
Senator, I look forward to seeing plans that are very, very clear.
The question is, why have you not proposed it? Why have you not made a proposal?
That they will not cut Social Security. This president has put it in black and white. We look forward to seeing a plan that suggests that Social Security is off the table. This president believes the biggest threat to Social Security are those who want to cut it. His budget says no.
Shalanda Young is the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, OMB, also known as the White House Budget Director. Question by Senator Mitt Romney, Republican from Utah, at today's Budget Committee hearing. On Wednesday, the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen will be testifying before the Senate Finance Committee about the president's proposed fiscal year 2024 budget. You can listen live Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern, here on C-SPAN Radio. President Biden today talking about lowering the cost of prescription drugs at an event in Las Vegas, Nevada. He praised the pharmaceutical company Novo Nordisk for its decision to cut the cost of insulin, becoming the second company to do so after Eli Lilly. President also announcing that drug makers will be facing fines for raising prices on some drugs faster than inflation for people on Medicare, provision in last year's Inflation Reduction Act. Companies violating the law will be required to pay Medicare a rebate to cover the difference. Here's the president.
Insulin was invented 100 years ago. And the guy who invented decided not to patent it because he wanted it to be available. It only costs $10 a vial to make. $10 a vial. If you count everything expanded, you can say you get up to 13 bucks if you talk about packaging, shipping, and the rest. And guess what? They're being charged hundreds of dollars a vial. So beginning January 1st of this year, even though we passed the law last year, wasn't until January 1st I kept telling people it was coming, we capped the cost of insulin at $35. $35 for seniors on Medicare. And folks, if it had been in effect in 2020, nearly 11,000 Nevada seniors would have saved an average of $439 on their insulin. But I've been calling on my colleagues to cap the cost for everyone, you know, including 200,000 children who have type 1 diabetes, who need insulin every day to stay alive. I was doing a town hall meeting in Northern Virginia last year, and a woman stood up very sophisticated lady. She said, I have two girls. They both have type 1 diabetes. And she said, and I can't afford it. So what we have to do, we have to ration the insulin between them. Talk about being deprived of your dignity. Man, looking at your child, knowing if they don't get the insulin, their life is literally in danger. And you got to stand there and not know what to do. Folks, my budget's going to require it. And guess what? The good news is that Eli Lilly, the biggest insulin maker in the United States of America, announced that they're going to answer my call and they're going to make this insulin available to everyone in America for $35. And yesterday, Novadisc, another drug maker, announced they're cutting their price of insulin as well. Look, folks, another aspect of the Inflation Reduction Act, and it's a fancy-sounding phrase, but is the drug companies that raise prices faster than inflation have to pay back the difference to Medicare. So if they're raising the price and insulin, and Medicare and you have the circumstance where the inflation is up 4% and they increase it 12% or 15%, they have to pay the difference to Medicare. Yesterday, I learned that last quarter, drug companies hiked the prices for 27 drugs that are on the market above the new limit. Now those manufacturers are going to have to pay the difference back to Medicare. As a result, the Department of Health and Human Services estimate this will make co-pays for those drugs will be as much as $390 cheaper for seniors.
President Biden in Las Vegas, Nevada at UNLV today. On Wall Street, the Dow down 280, NASDAQ up 5, S&P down 27. A story from the New York Times, shares in Credit Suisse tumbled to a record low on Wednesday, leading a brutal day for banking stocks, as the embattled Swiss lender's biggest shareholder said it would not make further investments in the firm. A plunge of nearly 27% in Credit Suisse shares raised new worries about the banking industry on a day when broader European stock markets suffered sharp losses. The turmoil resurfaced on Wall Street, where investors were already anxious over the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank last week. That from New York Times. In Washington, D.C., reporters asking U.S. Senate leaders about what's next for possible investigations and regulations on this issue. First, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Do you support the Senator Warren bill to push back the deregulation of Dodd-Frank?
Okay, we need strong legislation. And hopefully we can put something together that's bipartisan. Yes.
Does anything about this crisis with SVB and other banks, does that concern you in the way that things were in 2008? And does that spook members in trying to figure out what is the right course of action in these circumstances?
Well, look, I have faith in President Biden, Secretary Yellen, and the Federal Reserve. They have all hands on deck to manage this and keep our economy sound.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, at a news conference on Capitol Hill. The Senate Republican leaders holding their own news conference. And Minority Whip John Thune of South Dakota taking questions.
Are you concerned about regional banks losing deposits to big banks in this crisis? And should there be unlimited guarantees of bank deposits to prevent these deposits from leaving the smaller banks when they're bigger?
Well, I think you heard Steve Daines speak to this, but there would be a lot of concern among people in most parts of the country, and certainly in rural parts of the country, that have banks that operate well, that are well managed, well capitalized, although capital wasn't really the issue with SVB, it was a liquidity issue. But I think there are people across the country who are watching this closely and are going to try to determine whether or not they're going to be on the hook for a lot of this mismanagement. But again, I would come back to the thing we want to get answered first and foremost is where did the regulators fail? Why did we not anticipate this and see this coming, knowing full well that there were lots of warning signs that should have tipped the regulators off?
Senator, on your side of the aisle, depending on how this investigation turns out, if they do say that regulators didn't have enough tools to prevent something like Silicon Valley Bank failure from happening, would there be any appetite on your side of the aisle to consider tougher regulation by legislation?
I think we want to get all the facts in, and I think that's where oversight comes into play. And we have a number of committees of jurisdiction, namely the Banking Committee, who I hope are going to get to the bottom of the questions that we have about why the the exam process, the supervision process failed before we get to that next question. I mean, if there are ideas out there that people have, at some point I'd be willing to entertain those, but I think it'd be premature to start talking about solutions before we fully define the problem and ultimately get answers from the regulators about why they were asleep at the job.
Senator John Thune, Republican from South Dakota, the minority whip, speaking with reporters. He was answering the questions in the place of the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, who is still recovering after a trip and fall last week. Politico has a story published Tuesday that begins 5 years to the day after Senate Democrats clashed bitterly over Donald Trump's bank deregulation. The failure of two banks is reigniting the old tension. President Joe Biden on Monday criticized the former president's loosening of bank regulations when Donald Trump and a Republican-controlled Congress approved a measure to roll back parts of the 2010 post-financial crisis reform bill known as Dodd-Frank. President Biden didn't mention that his own party played a significant role. That political article noting that 17 Democrats voted for the rollback 5 years ago in 2018. The Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says he's concerned about a recent increase in airline near misses and is calling on air carriers and government agencies to figure out why the country has seen what he calls more mistakes than usual for an industry that has not had a deadly airline crash in almost a decade. Secretary Buttigieg is speaking today at a safety summit called by the acting head of the Federal Aviation Administration, Billy Nolen. In a letter to participants, the secretary writing that he wants to accomplish three things: identifying patterns and risk factors, how different parts of the aviation system can address any risks, and identifying and implementing additional steps to reduce those risks. The secretary led off today's session.
And while the data are clear that U.S. aviation remains an exceptionally safe mode of travel, whether you compare it to other modes, whether you compare it to other places, or whether you compare it to other times in our own history, we take nothing for granted, and we are particularly concerned because we have seen an uptick in serious close calls that we must address together. Initial information suggests that more mistakes than usual are happening across the system, on runways, at gates when planes are pushing back, in control towers, and on flight decks. So today is about the entire system, which means it's about all of us. This is a key priority for the FAA, for the entire department, and for the Biden-Harris administration. I know it is for everybody who is gathered here. And that's why we're not going to rest easy with past success. We're going to consistently look for ways to enhance safety, including efforts that we already have underway, like rolling out the ASDEX taxiway arrival prediction features, modernizing airport infrastructure, moving forward with airport safety management system rules, and more. I don't need to tell anyone here why all of this matters so much. The compelling advocacy of families like those who lost loved ones in 2009 on Continental Flight 3407, in 2018 on Lion Air Flight 610, and in 2019 on Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 must remind us of what is at stake and continue to guide our critical safety mission. As we look at the recent incidents of the last year or so, and as NTSB and FAA continue to investigate, we can't wait for the next catastrophic event to seek the warning signs of today, fully determine the contributing factors, and swiftly address them. We're staying vigilant because we know that as long as technology and people and society continue to change, which is to say in perpetuity, we need our safety systems and our safety culture to evolve and adapt to those changes.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg at the Federal Aviation Administration Safety Summit today in McLean, Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. The FAA and the NTSB are currently investigating six close calls involving commercial planes in recent months, five at airports and one over the Pacific Ocean. Transportation Secretary tells ABC News that this year the U.S. is on track to see more than 20 close calls, and, quote, even one is one that I would not like to see happen. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. U.S. House Homeland Security Committee today holding a field hearing on immigration and border security in McAllen, Texas, on the U.S.-Mexico border. House Republican majority on the committee says the hearing is to, quote, examine the direct link between President Biden and Secretary Mayorkas's reckless border policies and the unprecedented crisis on our southwest border. Democrats on the Homeland Security Committee boycotting today. The ranking Democrat, Benny Thompson of Mississippi, putting out a statement saying instead of a fact-finding mission to develop better border security and immigration policies, Republicans are traveling to the border to attack the administration and try to score political points with their extreme rhetoric, despite having voted against the resources border personnel need. C-SPAN covered this hearing in Texas. First questions from the chair, Republican Mark Green of Tennessee, were to the U.S. Border Patrol Chief, Raul Ortiz.
Does DHS have operational control of our entire border?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you for that. I'd like to share it with the American people. This is the actual definition of operational control that is in the code, written into the code well before I came to Congress, the definition, and I appreciate the honesty of Chief Ortiz. Do you think that, let's play a video clip here. I just want to share this question.
Will you testify under oath right now? Do we have operational control, yes or no?
Yes, we do.
And we have operational control of the borders.
Yes, we do.
Chief Ortiz, do you think that Secretary Mayorkas is lying there?
Sir, when you talk about operational control, about 10 years ago, we used operational control as a measuring stick of our effectiveness along the southwest border. My new strategy is geared towards mission advantage.
So you know I'm asking a very specific question.
Yes, sir.
And you're kind of describing how the goalpost has been moved because of the mass waves of people that are coming. My question, you heard the secretary, he said we have operational control. That's the definition of operational control.
Based upon the definition you have, sir, up there, no.
We don't have operational control.
No, sir.
But is Secretary Mayorkas lying?
I didn't see the rest of the testimony there, sir.
He was asked if we had operational control, and he said yes. I think it's either ignorance, which is unacceptable, or it's lying. 4.7 million alien encounters, 1.3 million gotaways, a record number of individuals on the terrorist watch list, a record number of criminal alien encounters, a record number of aliens with gang affiliation encounters, a record number of drug seizures. Do these numbers project confidence to the American people that DHS has operational control?
I will tell you, I have confidence in the men and women that are executing the mission out there to the best of their ability.
I appreciate
that. We've seen across the southwest border 9 sectors, and out of those 9 sectors, 4 of them have significant resources. When you think about the double layer fencing, some of the surveillance technology, and then the amount of agents we deployed. But in 5 of those 9 southwest border sectors, we have seen an increase in flow, and that has caused a considerable strain on our resources and really has forced the Border Patrol to move agents and even migrants to some of the other areas.
Yeah, I pointed that out in my statement, too, that the cartels have figured out if they flood certain areas, you got to shift resources, and that's allowing them to have free reign. That, to me, is the cartels controlling the southern border. Does that... I mean, think about it for a second, like you're a military guy and that's the perimeter, right? Do the drug cartels have control of sections of the perimeter of the United States?
I will tell you that in certain areas, the cartels control an awful lot on the southern border, south of the United States. Our men and women are out there. I just spent the last 3 days here in South Texas patrolling with some of our agents, and they're doing a phenomenal job of responding to traffic that's coming across that border.
And that plays out
across the entire southwest border.
Raul Ortiz is the U.S. Border Patrol Chief. Questioned by Congressman Mark Green, Republican from Tennessee, chairs the Homeland Security Committee. Today's field hearing held in McAllen, Texas. This was the second hearing on border security and immigration to be held by House Republicans in the Rio Grande Valley this year. President Biden's proposed budget for the next fiscal year does have $25 billion for CBP and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, including money for 350 more Border Patrol agents. House Republicans have introduced their top legislative priority. It's an energy package titled the Lower Energy Costs Act and given the designation H.R. 1. The sponsor is Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana, the majority leader, who says in a press release the bill will restore American energy independence by increasing domestic energy production, reforming the permitting process for all industries, reversing anti-energy policies advanced by the Biden administration, streamlining energy infrastructure and exports, and boosting the production and processing of critical minerals. Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, promoted the bill in a video.
Every piece of legislation is assigned a number when it's first introduced. Most of these numbers are chronological. But as Speaker, I get to pick which bills are assigned the numbers 1 through 10 as a way to show how important that legislation is. I just announced H.R. 1, our top priority that has a real shot at becoming law. It's called the Lower Energy Cost, and it's going to do two big things. First, restore American energy leadership. Now how? By repealing onerous taxes and overregulation on American energy producers so we can lead the world in providing clean, affordable energy. Now second, make it easier to build in America. Every time we need a pipeline, a road, or a dam, on average, it takes almost 5 years, and millions of dollars in costs get added to the project to comply with Washington's permitting process. That's way too long if we want to compete against China. We can streamline permitting and still protect the environment. Now, that's a goal worthy of number one.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican, posting that video this week when the bill was officially introduced. Today, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, giving a statement in opposition.
Today, House Republicans rolled out a partisan, dead-on-arrival proposal to address America's energy needs that they had the nerve to name H.R. 1. H.R. 1 will lock America into the most expensive and volatile dirty sources of energy, will set America back a decade or more in our transition towards clean, affordable energy. The package is a wish list for big oil, gutting important environmental safeguards on fossil fuel projects while doing none of the important permitting reforms that would bring transmission and clean energy projects online faster. Transmission is vital to getting green energy from where it's produced to where the people are, and they don't have the kind of transmission reform, any modicum of it, that is needed. Any serious permitting package must also focus on the needs of the future as America transitions to clean energy. We need to take steps in Congress to ease that transition, ensure that clean energy is reliable, accessible, and most of all, affordable. That includes efforts to expedite onshoring and construction of industries critical to our national security, like we did in chips and science. Permitting reform is an essential step in laying the foundation of the energy future. Thankfully, there are Democrats and Republicans talking in both houses to permit a deal forward. We need a bipartisan, bicameral effort on permitting reform, and I would do everything I can to get that to happen.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, at a news conference on Capitol Hill. Josh Siegel is an energy and climate reporter for Politico, has been tracking this issue, joining us now by phone. Thank you. So what is in this House Republican Energy Reform Bill?
Right. So this is H.R. 1, the Lower Energy Costs Act, and it's been long in the making and anticipated. And basically, it incorporates a bunch of Republican bills that they've been working on even when they were in the minority in the House, and they've kind of updated them. So basically, it combines measures to streamline permitting reviews, which, of course, is kind of this bipartisan concept that's gained some momentum to make it easier to build all sorts of energy projects in this country. So that's a part of it. And their goal is to maybe make some of that bipartisan after they go through this process. But then there's a lot of really more political, just kind of like high level ideas that Republicans have been talking about for a long time. such as prohibiting a ban on fracking, which of course hasn't happened and no one's threatening to do, mandating oil and gas lease sales on federal lands, which is trying to get at President Biden's approach to that. And he did ban new lease sales at the beginning of his term, disapproving of the president's decision to kill the Keystone XL pipeline, which they've always talked about doing. And then some moves to repeal parts of the Inflation Reduction Act that Democrats are so proud of, and their trademark climate law. So and that includes a methane tax that they feel is burdensome on the oil and gas industry. So it kind of combines, some maybe bipartisan threads, but really is, they're kind of what we would do on energy policy if we have control. And then this is what they are in a position to do now.
Speaker McCarthy, in a video promoting this bill that was introduced this week, says it has a real shot of becoming law. Does it?
No, as a whole, in this form, it doesn't at all. And if you actually talk with, I've had a number of conversations with Bruce Westerman, who's the chair of the House Natural Resource Committee, Republican, who's really leading a leader in this. He's a close ally of McCarthy. And he's very upfront that, look, I mean, the Democrats aren't going to support some of what we're doing in here on oil and gas and even on mining. There's a lot of provisions to make it easier to mine in this country. So those pieces are not going to be considered by Democrats. But again, there's this thought that Republicans are really pushing, and that some Democrats who I talk to are open to, of, okay, the permitting components, where maybe there's some threads of agreement. Can we go and turn around after the House Republicans pass this big package? No, it won't move over to the Senate to be considered. But can there then be a negotiation in taking what Republicans did on permitting and combining that also with what Democrats and Joe Manchin tried to do late last year and failed to do? Can we find some sort of common ground there?
We're talking with Josh Siegel from Politico. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer did reference that there are Democrats and Republicans talking both in the House and the Senate about that permitting reform. Does it have a real shot of coming together?
Yeah, I mean, it's always good. I'm always going to, preface that it's a high, a lot of hurdles, high bar to pass major policy right in divided government. We all know 2024 presidential election is looming. But this is a topic that has a lot of momentum. There's a lot of cross interests around, it's hard to build. Not only, Republicans come at this from, it's always been hard to do pipelines and fossil fuel infrastructure. But now it's really clean energy that there's going to be a need to build a lot of wind and solar and transmission lines that deliver, the power to actual demand centers across states. And that's very hard to permit in this country. And so there's this kind of merging of interests. But actually coming up with something that crosses, that checks enough boxes for people without, offending progressives who are concerned about getting too deep into environmental laws and cutting off input from communities. And then also on the Republican side, there is some discomfort with transmission, which I mentioned, which is really the Democratic priority and something Chuck Schumer mentioned in criticizing the Republican approach. They don't have anything specifically to help transmission. And Democrats think the federal government should have kind of more authorities to come in and be involved when states and local governments also have a role in permitting those and to maybe, override the state and local governments there. So, there's some contentious pieces of this that are going to be hard to reconcile. But at a high level, there's a lot of agreement that something has to happen.
Final question. H.R. 1 is symbolically the top legislative priority of the House Republican majority, but it's taken 3 months to put this together. Should we read anything into that?
Yeah, I mean, what I think it says is that Republican leadership who I talk with, consistent that they wanted to at least go through the committee process. They wanted to have hearings, markups, and just go through the whole process. They felt like Democrats with the Inflation Reduction Act, of course, that was done through reconciliation. So that was meant to, bypass the filibuster in the Senate. So there wasn't a process there. So they felt like we at least have to do that. Now, at the same time, they didn't bring in Democrats as part of this negotiation, right? I mean, this was strictly among Republicans, and they did want to get it out in the public, at least to some extent. So that's why it took a little bit. But this is still fast for, again, it's their first real policy push, and it reflects that they've been working on these aren't new ideas. These are, you know, somewhat off the shelf with some updates. I think that explains the timing.
Josh Siegel, energy and climate reporter for Politico. His story at politico.com and on Twitter. He's at SiegelScribe. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And the House Republican leadership says that this bill, H.R. 1, the energy package, will be debated and voted on the House floor the last week of March. That's the week of March 27th. We'll have coverage, of course, gavel to gavel of the House on C-SPAN television, streamed at C-SPAN.org. You can follow on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. EPA Assistant Administrator for Water, Radhika Fox, explaining more today about the announcement Tuesday from the EPA of the first federal limits on PFAS chemicals, also known as forever chemicals, in drinking water. The chemicals do not degrade in the environment and have been linked to serious health issues, including low birth weight and cancer. Administrator Fox testifying before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee today. The chair is Senator Tom Carper, Democrat from Delaware.
EPA yesterday released, as we know, the proposed drinking water standard for six types of PFAS chemicals. I want to commend you and Administrator Regan for your leadership in proposing a standard that is based in science and a standard that protects the public to the maximum extent possible. These forever chemicals are prolific throughout the environment, and under President Biden's leadership, EPA has taken another significant step to address their presence in our water with yesterday's decision. Question, can you, Ms. Fox, can you please give us some more background on the standard and explain the next step for the agency's action in this regard?
Thank you for the question, Senator. And I want to thank you and Senator Capito and other members of this committee that have kept us focused on getting this, this drinking water standard proposed. I was talking to Senator Capito yesterday, I said, in the 2 years that we've had conversations, I don't think there's a single time that we spoke where you don't ask about this. So we're really, truly thrilled to be at this key milestone. So the science on PFAS is clear. Exposure, even at very low levels, is very harmful to human health. And what we also know about the science is that people are exposed to PFAS from a variety of means, from their air, their land, and their water. But when PFAS is in drinking water, we know it is one of the most significant contributors to the harmful health effects that people face. So, you know, as we think about making progress on this critical issue for the American people, having a national drinking water standard that keeps PFAS out of our drinking water, that is one of the best things that we can do as a nation from a human health perspective. We're very proud of the proposal that we announced yesterday. It is based in the latest peer-reviewed science, and the science is evolving rapidly as it relates to PFAS. So it's grounded in the latest peer-reviewed science. And it also learned from, you know, the dozen states that already have established MCLs for PFAS in drinking water. As you said, Senator, the proposal calls for regulating six PFAS. We're proposing to set an MCL, a maximum contaminant level, of 4 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFOS. 4 parts per trillion is the level at which we can detect PFAS in our drinking water, and we have laboratory capacity to do that. We also are proposing to regulate 4 additional PFAS as a mixture, because these 4 PFAS are known to co-occur in drinking water. This is Gen X, PFBS, PFNX, and PF8, anyway, alphabet soup of PFAS. But with those 4, we're setting a hazard index for those 4 PFAS. Also, some of the other features of the rule proposal that we're very pleased with is the public notification requirements, which is so important so that the American people can know. We, I think, have developed a flexible approach to monitoring and compliance, recognizing that water systems are in different places. The next steps are we're in a 60-day public comment period, so we're very much looking forward to engaging with our state co-regulators, local water systems, community organizations to get feedback on this proposal, and we are really working hard to get to a final rule by the end of 2023 or very early in 2024. And so, again, thank this committee for your wonderful leadership on PFAS.
You're welcome. And that's it's a shared responsibility.
Senator Tom Carper, chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee, questioning the EPA Assistant Administrator for Water, Radhika Fox, at today's hearing on water infrastructure. Associated Press article as this: EPA estimates the rule could reduce PFAS exposure for nearly 100 million Americans, decreasing rates of cancer, heart attacks, and birth complications. The chemicals had been in use since the 1940s in consumer products and industry, including nonstick pans, food packaging, and firefighting foam. Their use is now mostly phased out in the U.S., but some still remain. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.